Hi, everyone. Welcome to Lab Medicine's podcast series. This is Kelly Swales, the web editor for Lab Medicine Journal. And today I have with me Dr. Hui Pham. He's going to talk a little bit about therapeutic apheresis.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the invitation. My name is Hui Pham, and I am currently the Transfusion Medicine Fellow at the Joint Program between Columbia University Medical Center and the New York Blood Center. Today, I will talk with you about what apheresis is, an overview of apheresis, as well as the new apheresis guideline that dictate the treatment on most apheresis that recently published in the special edition of the Journal of Clinical Apheresis in July of last year.
So, Dr. Pham, what exactly is apheresis?
Well, so apheresis is the term derived from the Greek word. Let me see if I can pronounce it correctly, apheresis. I would assume so. It means to remove some substance forcefully. So generally, this is a process in which the blood from the subject will come to a machine that is separated into components extracorporeally. What I meant by component, meaning they separated into the red cell, platelet, white cell, and plasma based on the density most of the time. And then we will remove the desired blood component that we want. And when we return the remaining of the component back to the patient. This procedure can either be used to collect blood components, which we usually refer to the term donor apheresis, or as a therapeutic modality, we call them therapeutic apheresis. In the podcast, we will only discuss about therapeutic apheresis to give you guys an overview of what it is and how we approach a request for a therapeutic apheresis. We will not refer to any specific disease, but we will tell you how to handle an apheresis request if you get that request.
In general, how do we perform apheresis?
Currently, the apheresis procedure are done by a number of FDA-approved machines. They can be either operated continuously or semi-continuously automated machines. And in the U.S., the most common technique is centrifugation-based, and then we separate the component based on the density. And in the U.S., the most common machine that's used for therapeutic apheresis is the COBE machine. It's a manufactured by COBE, but recently it was marked by Terumo. In addition, besides using the COBE, the centrifugation-based method for apheresis, we can also have some specialized apheresis machine that remove the blood element specifically. For the COBE, we do not really specifically remove components. For example, we can have some machine that remove lipid only, called LDL apheresis, to introduce in the treatment of familial hyperlipidemia. Or we can, Terracos also had a number of machines that do photopheresis. That means we only remove the white cell layer of the left from the patient, and then we will treat them with 8-methoxyprednisolone or called AMOP, and then we return that and to the patient to treat disease like cutaneous T cell lymphoma. That's called photopheresis.
What sort of vascular access does the patient need in order to undergo apheresis?
So as you know, that the apheresis principle is that you have to remove the blood from the patient. And usually, in order to put the patient on the machine, let's take the COBE for an example, it requires a high blood flow rate in order for the machine to work. So usually, that can be achieved with a large peripheral access vein. You usually need a 17 gauge needle or larger needle. We will usually ask them to do a 13.5 French double lumen dialysis needle. For some patients, if their vein is not good, we cannot use peripheral vein, we can put in a central venous catheter. And certainly, central venous catheter also carries some risk of infection and bleeding and things like that. Single vascular access is used for the intermittent or discontinuous flow machine. In most of the therapeutic apheresis, we use dual access because it allows for continuous flow and it tends to be more efficient to remove the desirable component that way.
What sort of replacement fluids do we use?
lets you know that if you remove more than 15% of the total blood volume of any patient, we will need to give some replacement fluid to replace the volume we remove. Otherwise, the patient might develop hypotension and tachycardia. So the replacement fluid is used to maintain the intravascular volume. We have a couple choices for therapeutic apheresis. They are plasma, albumin, or normal saline. And you know that each of these specific choice come up with their advantage and disadvantage, or the risk and the benefit. For example, for the plasma, the benefit is that you will provide some of the coagulation factor, all of the coagulation factor back in the patient. However, you see, a blood product is carry transfusion reaction risk, such as trolley and allergic reaction, things like that. And for albumin, you know, we can maintain the intravascular volume better with normal than normal saline, but it is also like a plasma-derived protein. It also carries risk, and it's a little bit more expensive. For like normal saline, it's because only a third of that will be in the remaining intravascular, so that is the disadvantage. But it is relatively cheap, and it carries virtually no risk of infection, transmitted disease. So the choice of the fluid depends on the disorder that the patient is being treated, as well as the patient's comorbidities.
So what are the typical adverse events we usually see in those patients that undergo therapeutic apheresis?
So therapeutic apheresis in general is a very, very safe procedure. And in the medical literature, it's only reported only about 3% of the reaction rate. It's most of the reaction related to the citrate toxicity due to hypocalcemia. Because you know that in order to keep the blood running in the circuit, we need to anticoagulant the blood to make sure that it doesn't clot. And for therapeutic apheresis using the COP machine, most procedures are carried out using citrate as the anticoagulant. For all the procedures like photophoresis, we can use heparin, but for regular apheresis, we use citrate. And citrate will bind to calcium, which leads to hypocalcemia. And with mild hypocalcemia, the patient can develop tingling, oral paresthesia, nausea, vomiting, and maybe chest discomfort. But severe reaction, that is what we are really worried about, can result in tachy, cardiac arrhythmias, seizure, and it might be lethal. So that is the symptom for hypocalcemia, which is related to the citrate anticoagulant that we use. And then also, you know, because part of the blood are outside of the body in the machine, they can also develop hypotension. We call that fluid shift, or they may be anxious and they have vasovagal reaction. Specifically for apheresis, patients with an ACE inhibitor, such as lisinopril, they might develop facial flushing and refractory hypotension due to the generation and accumulation of excess bradykinin. And ACE inhibitor inhibits the breakdown of bradykinin. And you know, bradykinin is a very potent vasodilator. So this patient might develop a severe hypotension. In addition, allergic and transfusion reaction might also happen during the procedure if the replacement fluid you use is blood product, such as red cell or plasma.
For those patients that do undergo a reaction during the apheresis procedure, what are the sort of treatment options that we have?
So usually for mild citrate toxicity, if the patient only develops some mild tingling, periorbital tingling, or like some chest discomfort, nausea, vomiting, we can slow down the citrate infusion rate or temporarily pause the procedure. And we can also adjust the whole blood to ACD ratio to give them less citrate, pretty much. We can also give the patient some oral calcium supplement like Tums. In our unit, we can give them to drink some milk and cheese and eat cheese to help them with some calcium. For the severe toxicity, we should pause the procedure and we need to give IV calcium at that time. You can give either calcium chloride or calcium gluconate. The patient who is at risk for citrate toxicity are the one with a small size, like pediatric patients, because citrate is metabolized by the liver in the patient with hepatic dysfunction. They are also at risk for citrate toxicity. And you know that because plasma and red cell, they are also stored in citrate. So in addition to the citrate that the patient receives from apheresis procedure, when you use red cell or plasma as the replacement fluid, you can also put in a lot more citrate in from the product to the patient. So those patients with blood product as replacement fluid also are at risk for citrate CCD. If the patient develops hypotension either from the fluid shift or from vasovagal, we can only put the patient in a transdermal position, or we can give the patient bolus fluid, such as 250 milliliter bolus of albumin or saline. For the patient who took the ACE inhibitor, for the non-urgent procedure, we usually recommend them to hold apheresis, and then we do not start apheresis until 24 hours post the last dose of the ACE inhibitor. If it's an emergent procedure, like doing a TTP case, for example, the risk will be weighed against the benefit, and we might be able to go ahead with the procedure after discussing with the ICU team and the patient, and they need to be ready to resuscitate the patient if hypotension developed.
So as you say, Dr. Pham, there are risks with this procedure, even though it's generally safe. When or how do we decide that apheresis is appropriate for a patient?
Theoretically, in order to decide whether apheresis is appropriate for the patient, most of us apply the McLeod criteria to determine the success of the apheresis. This McLeod criteria have three components. The first component is called plausible pathogenesis, meaning that there must be a good understanding of the disease pathogenesis to suggest a clear rationale for apheresis. The second criteria is called red blood. This means that the abnormality in the blood that makes apheresis plausible should be meaningfully corrected by apheresis. And the third component is the peripheral patient clinical effect. That's what it's called. It means that there must be a strong evidence that apheresis confers clinical benefit that is meaningful for the patient. Let me give you an example of how we apply McLeod criteria. For example, if you get a request for a therapeutic plasma exchange in a patient with myasthenia gravis, for example. So the first criteria meaning plausible pathogenesis, meaning there is a good understanding of the disease pathogenesis. Well, we understand that for myasthenia gravis, that this disease is due to the antibody. Again, the acetylcholine receptor. So we have an antibody that in the blood, which leads to the second criteria, meaning that removal of that bad blood will help the patient. Well, we know that the pathogenesis is the antibody. Therefore, and this antibody is in the plasma. Therefore, it's logically that if we remove the plasma, meaning we remove the antibody, the patient would get better. And leading to the third criteria, meaning is there any evidence that show that working? Well, we had a couple of randomized control trials that show that the patient with myasthenia gravis, when they go under therapeutic plasma exchange, they get better. Therefore, myasthenia gravis met the three criteria in the McLeod criteria to use plasma exchange at the therapeutic modality.
Is there any evidence-based guideline to help clinicians decide if apheresis is appropriate? And if so, does it include the technical details they need to know for the procedure?
As you know, that the medicine field is getting larger and larger every day, and we cannot really keep up with all of them. Well, so understanding the need of that, the American Society for Apheresis, or SHORC, we call them ASPA, they started to publish evidence-based guidelines on this issue since 2007. And every 3 years, they publish an updated version of the guideline to help the clinician with the appropriateness of apheresis request, as well as the technicality of the procedure. The most recent guideline was published in the special edition of the ASPA Journal of Clinical Apheresis in July of 2013 that encompassed most of the disease that have been treated by any modality of apheresis in the medical literature. And then the clinician is urged to consult this guideline whenever they are faced with an apheresis request to determine the appropriateness of the request. They are also urged to publish data NK report, NK series, and conduct randomized trial for any new disease that they think that apheresis might be helpful.
How does ASFA come up with the guidelines?
Well, in order to come up with the guidelines, this is a guideline based on expert consensus. So ASFA selected experts in the field that comprise of the ASFA Journal of Clinical Apheresis Special Issue Writing Committee. For the most recent version of this guideline, the 2013 committee consists of 10 experts in the diverse field, ranging from hematology to nephrology to transfusion medicine and apheresis across the United States. Because, as you might know, the department that is running the apheresis in the hospital is not only unique to pathology and laboratory medicine. In some hospitals, they are running by hematology. In some other hospitals, they are running by nephrology. Therefore, ASPA decides to comprise up on the experts in on the field in order to get a well representative. So these experts, after they get selected, they will be reviewed the disease for which publication in the literature describes apheresis and the medical treatment. They will review up on the publications. Each of these members will be assigned some disease, like 5 to 7 disease to look up, and this primary author will create a fact sheet that summarizes the disease incident, description, management, rationale, technical note, volume treated, replacement fluid use, treatment frequency, optimal apheresis duration, and reference based on whatever they found during their medical literature search on the disease they assigned to. And then these first drafts were then reviewed by two other members of the committee, followed by an outside specialist review for selected fact sheets. So it undergoes extensive review and updated and discussion regarding what they put in that fact sheet. And then they finalize to a one-page fact sheet for each disease. And then after that, they will come together, meeting face-to-face, to decide what categories and what graded of recommendation, in which we will discuss later in the podcast, of each disease for a final consensus. So this is a very simple fact sheet that summarizes everything we know at this point for each disease that is treated for the apheresis. But the process behind it is very complicated. So for the indication of apheresis of each disease, it is now broken into 4 categories. They will assign 1 category to each disease in the fact sheet. So they go from 1 to 4. So the category 1 is assigned to the disease where the indication for apheresis is accepted as the first line therapy, either as a standalone treatment or in conjunction with other treatment modalities. An example for the category 1 disease treatment by apheresis is, as everyone knows, ATTP. A category 2 disease is assigned to the disease where the apheresis is accepted as a second-line treatment, either as a standalone treatment or in conjunction with other treatment modalities. An example of this is the using the rest of exchange in the acute chest syndrome patient. A category 3 disease is assigned to a disease where the optimal role of apheresis is not yet established and the decision-making should be individualized, meaning if you get a request to do an apheresis procedure in a patient with a category 3 disease, you need to weigh the risk and the benefit and discuss with the clinical team to see whether apheresis should be pursued. An example of this category 3 disease may be, let's say, in a paraneoplastic syndrome in the patient with neurological disorder. And then the last one is category 4. It's assigned to a disease where published evidence have been demonstrated or suggested that apheresis is ineffective, is not effective at all, or even harmful to the patient. Meaning that if you get a request to do an apheresis procedure in a patient with a category 4 disease, you should strongly recommend against it, or you only perform it with IRB approval. However, throughout each version of the guideline, the expert can move disease between categories. An example of the category 4 disease in the past, meaning in the 2010 version, was stiff person syndrome. But now, with more and more evidence coming out that apheresis might be helpful, stiff person syndrome have been moved to category 3 now in the 2013 apheresis guideline. Therefore, you should use the most recent updated version of the guideline because it can move back and forth between categories. And then after you assign the category to each disease, they will also assign the grading recommendations will be provided along with the category in the fact sheet. The grade recommendation is broken into grade 1 and 2. Each of them will have 3 levels, A, B, C. Grade 1 recommendation is a strong recommendation. It has 3 levels, A, B, C, according to the high, moderate, and low quality of evidence. An example of a high quality of evidence, randomized controlled trial, or overwhelming evidence from observational study. Example of moderate quality of evidence, randomized controlled trial with important limitations like conflicting results or some flaw in the study design or some strong evidence from observational studies. The example for the low quality evidence observational study and case series and case report. And similarly for the grade 2 recommendation, which represent the weak recommendations, they also have 3 level A, B, C. So after that, that will complete the fact sheet.
So how should we approach a request for apheresis?
This is the most important question that a lot of people have been asked and wondering how we should do this. After listening to this theoretical discussion of apheresis at the beginning of this podcast, of course, everyone will be curious. So when you are faced with a performance of an apheresis procedure, the following guidelines should be considered. First of all, you should consider the rationale of apheresis. What is the rationale for using apheresis in the treatment of the patient's disease? Is there a clear rationale for apheresis? Does it correct the abnormality? And is there clinical evidence that apheresis benefits the patient? Meaning you should review the disease using the McLeod criteria. I know in the clinical world, we don't have a lot of time to do that. Therefore, you should use the ASPR guidelines as a review first, and then you can see what category and grade recommendations that the expert put for that disease entity. And of course, this is not comprised of only disease have been treated by apheresis in the medical literature. If you are faced with a totally new disease, you should review the McLeod criteria more carefully before proceeding with the request. And if it's totally new and novel, you should publish it. So the next guideline might incorporate that in. So we can have more and more diseases that have been treated by apheresis in the guideline. And we can also consider the impact of apheresis in the patients. For example, what effect does the apheresis have on the patient's comorbidities and medications? As you know that for, let's say, for therapeutic plasma exchange, we remove both the antibodies, the bad thing and the good thing, because it is not selective in remove. So for plasma exchange, we remove both, let's say, both the antibodies that cause the disease, as well as all the good immunoglobulin, as well as some of the medications. So you need to talk to the team to see what effect does that have, what medication need to be redosed after apheresis, and if the patient is coagulopathic, maybe you need to replace with some plasma at the end to replace the coagulation factor in order to hold the patient not to bleed. And you can also need to consider the technical issue, like what anticoagulant does the patient need. If you had a request with photopheresis and the patient have hit heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, what should you do? Should you use Citrate or what can you do? You should also consider the replacement fluid. Can this patient tolerate albumin and or normal saline as the only fluid? Do we need to give them some plasma, for example, for therapeutic plasma exchange? For red cell exchange, what kind of red cell should we give this patient? And you also should look at the patient, just look what vascular access can we get? Can this patient tolerate the peripheral access, or do we need a central venous catheter? If we need a central venous catheter, do we need to put in a IJ line or does a femoral line? Okay. And we also need to look at the volume of the blood process should be used. for a general therapeutic blood exchange, maybe one blood volume is enough. But if we do a leukapheresis for the patient with hyperviscosity due to leukemia cells, maybe we need to process two blood volume. These technical issues also have been discussed in the ASPR guideline. So we recommend you to consult the ASPR guideline to answer some of these technical issues. But the decision should always be individualized for each patient. And we also need to consider the plan for apheresis. How many procedures total should we perform? And what is the frequency that a therapeutic apheresis should be performed? For example, if the antibodies that are causing the disease in IgG antibody, we recommend to perform them every other day for therapeutic plasma exchange due to the distribution of both intra and extravascular of the IgG antibodies. If the antibodies is IgM, then we might do it daily because IgM is mainly intravascular. And how many procedures should we perform? And what endpoint should we use? Is it clinical endpoint? Do we have an objective measure of this endpoint? Or can we use a laboratory endpoint? For TTP, we can use the platelet count and the LDH, the laboratory endpoint. However, for many neurological diseases, all we have is the clinical endpoint. So we should discuss with the team what clinical exam that we need to consider to decide whether apheresis works or should we stop this procedure because it is futile. And the more objective the evidence, the endpoint is, the better that we can assess the efficacy of the apheresis. And last but not least, we need to determine the time and the location where we can perform the apheresis. Is it an urgent procedure? If you get a call for the middle of the night, do we need to perform this procedure in the middle of the night now? Or can the patient wait till the morning and we can go ahead and perform the procedure? And then each of them, you know, have their own advantage and disadvantage. In the middle of the night, we have less staff, and therefore we have less experienced people to deal with if the patient have an adverse event. So it's only preferable to perform the procedure during the day where we have everyone around. But is this an urgent procedure? The guideline can also help you to answer that question as well. And we need to determine, can we perform this apheresis in the regular floor patient, or do we need the patient to be in the ICU? That also should be weighted when you assess the patient's clinical status. Can the patient undergo some abrupt fluid shift and does it need to be in the ICU or not? So that is also a question that you need to be considered when evaluate your apheresis request. So I hope that I have provided you with a review of what apheresis is, and as well as the summary of the ASPR guideline and how it arrived with the indication for the disease, as well as how to approach an apheresis request in general.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pham, for giving our listeners an overview of apheresis and the new published guidelines. I'm sure they're going to find it very helpful.
Thank you.